The National Broadcasting Company now brings a special international program. In just a few moments, we will hear from Mr. Anthony Eden, the Foreign Minister of Great Britain. We take you now to London.
Here is Mr. Anthony Eden, the Foreign Secretary, who will be heard by listeners both at home and overseas.
I'm just back from a long journey. I'm glad to be home, but I'm even more glad that I went. It's not the first time I have made the journey to Russia. Nearly 7 years ago, I was in Moscow. We were not at war then. The sky was not even overcast, but the clouds of war were beginning to gather on the distant horizon. You could just discern them. That was why I was in Moscow in 1935, talking with Mr. Stalin. I believed then, as I believe now, that there was no real conflict of interest between the Soviet Union and this country. We both said so in our communique at the time. I believed then, as I believe now, that despite the many obvious differences, our overriding purpose was the same. We both wished to maintain the peace. Well, we lost that peace. But we are determined not to lose this war or the peace that will follow it. And so I was glad of a chance to go again to Moscow, to speak again with Mr. Stalin. The Royal Navy carried us to our destination in North Russia with swift, quiet efficiency. They were wonderful hosts, but it was not an easy journey. We drove through heavy winter seas, and at one time, so they told us, we had tons of ice on board. I confess I was glad when we had rounded the North Cape and were sailing along the Murmansk coast. It was snowing hard in the dim half-light of the Arctic noon, where the sun never rises above the horizon in the winter months, when we landed on Soviet soil. A detachment of Russian soldiers were drawn up on the shore. They were a grand type of man, dressed in their warm sheepskin coats. A much more practical uniform, I can tell you, than the ersatz clothing and the sweepings of Goebbels' jumble sail in which Hitler's armies have to retreat through the Russian snows. These Russian soldiers were flanked by officers carrying the Union Jack and the hammer and sickle. The yellow ochre of the uniforms, the bright splashes of color of the two flags against the snow-covered hills, the uncanny twilight at midday, the silence of falling snow, all these formed a most impressive setting for our first landing on Soviet soil. But it was friendly. Indeed, the courtesy and friendliness of this greeting was typical of our welcome at every stage of our journey. Flying conditions were very bad, so we traveled to Moscow by train. One stretch of our journey was over a section of the railway which Goebbels has often told you has been cut by enemy action. I can tell you from practical experience that Goebbels is wrong. The railway is intact, undamaged, and working smoothly and well. It was on this journey that we first understood the meaning of a Russian winter. An occasional stop gave us a chance to stretch our legs and to freeze our moustaches in a temperature of 58 degrees of frost. To keep an engine running in such a temperature is a problem all to itself. To keep a human body alive, if you don't know just how to set about it, is not too easy either. All this and much more the Germans are learning in the Russian winter. Our ambassador in Moscow, Sir Stafford Cripps, came somewhere north from the city to meet us. Mr. Maisky, the Soviet ambassador in London, was the best of traveling companions. They both gave our delegation most valuable help in every phase of our work. Mr. Molotov and other representatives of the Soviet government met us on our arrival late at night in Moscow, the city Hitler had hoped to capture long ago. The next day, we began our series of talks with Mr. Stalin and Mr. Molotov in the Kremlin. These talks went further than any political or military discussions that have taken place at any time between our two countries since the last war. They fell naturally into two parts. In the first, we dealt with the conduct of the war. You won't expect me to tell you a great deal about that. Events will speak for themselves, I hope. But this assurance I can give you, that when our communique speaks of our identity of views on all questions relating to the conduct of the war, those words are not mere diplomatic jargon. They tell you the literal and absolute truth. I have no doubt in my mind that this part of our work alone would have more than justified the journey. But personally, I attach as much importance to the discussions which we had on the organization of peace and security after the war. We talked over what must be done to prevent any German aggression in the future. We talked over the conditions of the peace and the machinery for keeping it. Obviously, the Soviet government and ourselves alone could take no final decisions at our meeting. Intimate consultations with the governments of the Dominions, with the United States, and with our other allies will be necessary in the months that lie ahead. We must move forward together. But it is all to the good that a start has been made in the discussion of these questions between ourselves and the Soviet government. Wherever I went in Russia, I found the note was one of confidence and resolution, and not a confidence based on any light-hearted underestimate of the enemy. The Russians know very well how formidable is the German military machine. But they believe that they have now the measure of their foe. They are determined that he shall pay to the uttermost for the destruction of the towns and villages, the farms and factories of the Soviet Union. The method that Hitler chose for his attack, the sudden, unheralded swoop upon a people with whom he'd signed a pact of friendship only 9 months before. That method gave him, no doubt, valuable military advantages to begin with. But politically, it was stark lunacy. Hitler united all Russia by that one act. He made the war a crusade to rid the Soviet Union of the last German. In all the territory Hitler has overrun, there is not one Russian Quisling. All through the summer and autumn, Soviet forces were engaged in a fighting retreat. They defended every farm and field so as to wear down their enemy. Well, now the tide has turned. Russian counterattacks had developed into counteroffensive. The Germans will now have to bear the bitterness and the cruelty of a Russian winter. Whatever lies Hitler may tell, his armies were not prepared for that. The spirit of these Russian troops is magnificent. Their morale is higher than ever. They are striking at the retreating Germans without mercy and without respite. I saw a little of this myself. We drove along the Moscow-Leningrad road to Klin and some miles beyond. There were plenty of signs of fighting by the roadside. Shell-torn trees, derelict guns and shattered homes. We saw something, too, of the scorched earth policy. Most of the houses in these parts are built of wood, the chimneys only being of brick, so that when the houses have been burnt, gaunt brick fingers point solitary to the sky. Scorched earth in a frozen land. The effect is even more awful than total destruction would be. It's difficult for those of us who are familiar with the Western Front of the last war to picture the giant distances. So when you look at a map of the Russian front, it's a good habit to have beside you one of England on the same scale. Then you'll realize that the German army has been driven back fast and far. For instance, we reached Klin at noon on a Friday. On the Monday, fighting had still been going on in the town. And though we drove perhaps 6 or 7 miles beyond it, I don't think that we were at any time within 20 miles of the nearest German. Hitler has always liked a war of movement. He is getting it now. We saw what had evidently been the scene of pretty tough fighting some few miles north of Klin. Russian and German tanks were knocked out by the roadside. In a ditch were frozen German corpses. On the way back, we saw a small group of German prisoners who'd been captured only the day before. I talked to some of them myself. They were young, not much more than boys, although three of them were NCOs, ill-clad and suffering bitterly from the cold. They were not a bit like the soldiers of a victorious army. They were just half a dozen more of Hitler's unhappy victims. I had a look at their clothing, and they were quite ready to talk about it. Their overcoats were thinner and lighter than the service overcoat worn by British troops in this country. The tunics, too, were thin and of poor material. The boots were an imitation of the Russian top boots, but not so stout or so worn. Even the tunic buttons were cheap and shoddy, and the whole turnout had an ersatz appearance. They had no gloves, and only thin cardigans, and they kept trying to pull the sleeves down over their frozen fingers. I asked them whether their clothing was typical of that issue to the German army on the Russian front. They said that it was. And from what I heard later, I'm sure they were telling the truth. But there is one exception I must make. Hitler's own personal SS troops are privileged and have distinctly better equipment. Remember that the worst of the Russian winter are still to come. You will understand then that there is reason for this Russian confidence. Reason indeed for anxious, heavy hearts in Germany. And now one word about supplies for the Russian army. The output of tanks and aeroplanes was of course affected by the first rush of the German advance. But the figures of Russian output are now climbing again to an extent which astounded me. Our help too, I'm glad to say, is coming along steadily. British material has been tried in battle and has proved itself. Good accounts were given of our aircraft, and the Hurricanes are especially popular. Our tanks, too, have done most valuable service at a critical time. The output of British and American factories is being put to splendid use on the Russian battlefield. You need have no shadow of doubt about that. The experience of my visit, the talks that I had with Mr. Stalin and Mr. Molotov, have convinced me that a closer political collaboration between us can and will be realized. We can't ignore the difficulties. We have to get rid of a legacy of suspicion on both sides. That is the contrast in forms of government. But I will never accept that this need divide us. What matters in foreign affairs is not the form of internal government of any nation, but its international behavior. The trouble with Hitler, for instance, was not that he was a Nazi at home. The trouble with him was that he would not stay at home. He was, and he is, a ruthless aggressor with an insatiable appetite for world dominion. He cannot tolerate free and independent nations, and no nation, no free nation, will be secure so long as he lives and the German military power is unbroken. Well, now, contrast this with Russia's attitude and our own. The Soviet Union is determined upon the utter defeat of Germany. So are we. The Soviet Union is determined to do all that is in its power to ensure that Germany cannot launch further wars upon the world. So are we. Out of the untold sufferings of the present war, the Soviet Union wishes to gain a lasting peace for all its people, so do we. For these common objects, we must work together to win the war and to win the peace. With the experience of our Moscow talks fresh in my mind, I am convinced that we can do both.
That is the end of the talk by Mr. Anthony Eden.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've just heard a special broadcast from London by Anthony Eden, Foreign Minister of Great Britain. H.V. Kaltenborn, NBC's noted news analyst, usually heard at this time, will be presented at 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time this afternoon over many of these stations. This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.